This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening, Africa. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Jason Patinkin, and here's what's coming up.
The personal stories I received from children who had been raped, or testimony of women who were victims of sexual violence, were harrowing and quite cruel. Yes, I heard traumatic stories of, you know, children as young as 14.
That was UNICEF spokesman James Elder on the impact on children of the violence in Ethiopia's Tigray region. This story and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Our top story today is in Chad.
Fidèle au serment fait à la nation et au peuple tchadien.
That is General Azem Bermendoa Aguna, the Chad Army Chief of Staff, announcing a few hours ago that the President, Idriss Deby, has been killed by rebel forces. He goes on to say, quote, "It is with profound emotion that we announce to the people of Chad the death this Tuesday, 20th April 2021, of the Marshal of Chad, Idriss Deby Itno, following injuries at the front," end quote. The army said Deby went to the front lines in the north of the country where Chadian troops were fighting rebels who had been advancing towards the capital, N'Djamena. While there has been no independent confirmation that Deby is dead in Chad, U.S. military officials have said they believe the announcement is real and that the president has died. Just hours before the military announcement, Chad's election commission had declared Deby the winner of the country's presidential election, which took place last week. The 68-year-old Deby had led the country since a coup in 1990. The military also announced that Deby's 37-year-old son, Mahamat Idriss Deby Itno, a four-star general, will head a military council and that the parliament and government have been dissolved. It said elections will be held within 18 months. For more on Deby's death and legacy and what might be next for Chad's government, my colleague Chinedu Ofor has spoken with Timothy Donongmaye, who is the head of VOA's French to Africa service. Here's a clip of their conversation.
His legacy is mostly of someone who tried to have Chad shine on the international scene, providing peacekeepers to various UN operations. But internally, he has done everything to consolidate power in his own hands and his family's hands. He has several sons and nieces and nephews who are in key positions in Chad. So many people in Chad believe that all the power was concentrated in his own family.
Now, talking about family, there are reports that his son is to assume the position of president or leader of the military council. What do we know about his son?
His son is a general. He has several general sons. His name is Mahamat Idriss Deby Itno. He is 37, and he is the head of the presidential guard. This is the most equipped corps of Chad's military. So he is in a strong position. He has that guard, the control of that guard. So he was well positioned to replace him. They set up a military council headed by that son of Deby. But according to Chad's constitution, the person next in the order of succession is the Speaker of the National Assembly.
It is stunning, isn't it, that a president was killed in a battlefield fighting rebels. What more do we know of what transpired before his death?
It's a tradition in Chad that the head of state sometimes goes to the front. You know, it was the case for the previous president, Hissène Habré, in December of 1990. He was on the front with former General Kamugé fighting Idriss Deby's rebels. And when he saw that the war was lost, he came back to N'Djamena and fled to Cameroon, then to Senegal. So, and also Deby being a general and a marshal, he thought it's expected that he goes to the front. He did it in the Lake Chad region when Boko Haram fighters killed about 100 Chadian troops there. He went there when Chad launched an offensive against Boko Haram.
Would it be a stretch to say that the sidelining of the head of the parliament by the general son of the late president, some are calling it a coup, is it?
In some way it is, because the normal succession process allows for the Speaker of the National Assembly to succeed the president. That's the normal order of things. But now that he's been sidelined, I don't know how else we can call it. It's a coup, in my opinion.
Security in Chad had already been fragile before the announcement of Debi's death. The country has experienced scores of attacks by Islamist militants over the past decade, and in recent weeks, rebel forces allegedly based in Libya have been pressing south. Earlier this week, the U.S. government ordered non-essential embassy staff out of the country and urged American citizens to leave. Today, the U.S. Embassy sent out an alert telling Americans in Chad that they should shelter in place, quote, due to the reported death of the Chadian president and the potential for unrest, end quote. Consular services at the embassy have been suspended. Chad is a member of the G5 Sahel nations that are cooperating on fighting insurgents in the region. The other members are Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger. The United States and France have supported their efforts with troops and military supplies. And for analysis of what Debi's death may mean for regional security, I reached out to Dan Eisinger, a research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Eisinger, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. So first of all, can you give us a bit of background on Chad's regional security role under Debi?
Strategically, Idriss Debi has been crucial to regional security efforts. That's true for conflicts going on in the sort of immediate Chadian theater right around the Lake Chad Basin, which that's sort of an area where you've seen the rise of Boko Haram and a lot of militant Islamist insurgent actors there. He's sent Chadian troops into northeastern Nigeria on multiple occasions to confront Boko Haram. He has really been sort of a pillar of security for that particular conflict. The multinational joint task force, which is the regional security actor for that particular conflict, they are headquartered in N'Djamena, the capital of Chad. And similarly, Chad is part of a group called the Sahel G5, confronting militant Islamists or violent extremists in areas around Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger. But Chadian forces have actually been deployed all the way to northern Mali, western Niger, and near northern Burkina Faso to help with that as well. And so they've just been a really crucial security partner for counterterrorism efforts in the wider region.
And in addition to the areas to Chad's west, he's also had forces involved in Libya to the north in the past. He's been involved in Darfur to the east of Chad. Now that Debi's gone, what are the things you'll be looking at across all of Chad's borders? And I should also add to the south, the Central African Republic. What will you be looking for in terms of the ramifications of his death and how that might affect Chad's neighbors and Chad itself, considering all these past forays by Debi?
It's a really great question and a really crucial thing for us to focus on now. As you point out, you know, Chad is sort of surrounded by instability and that has made it appear as though Chad was a fairly stable place because Idriss Debi had been in power for 3 decades and his party, the MPS, had been in power all of that time as well. And so it appeared to be stable. But the reality is that, under Debi's authoritarian rule, the autocratic governance that had really flourished under Debi was generating quite a bit of internal instability as well. It's why you see these various rebel movements, armed opposition movements. There's quite a bit of instability within Chad. And so what's really worrying now is that what comes next? And very few people, I think, have any clear idea of what that will be. And there are some indications that parts of the Chadian armed forces are quite fractured. And so it's not implausible that there could be a significant amount of instability in the near future. And given the instability within the broader region already, that's only going to help facilitate a cycle of conflict, a cycle of political violence. And so I think that's the kind of pessimistic outlook here. And so what I'll be watching is just what the next moves are from some key folks in Chad. How does the ruling party try to handle any kind of transition? There's reporting that Debbie's son has been named as interim head of state over a transition of some kind, but it's really unclear at this moment what that will mean. And what would be ideal is for some sort of inclusive transition to be enacted that brought together all different parties from Chadian society, civil society, different political actors, opposition movements, rebel movements. If a transition could be more inclusive for these different groups, I think that there'd be a greater chance for stability, or at least the prospects for stability and improved government would be higher.
That's Dan Eisinga, a research fellow at the Africa Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Eisinga, thank you so much for joining us.
Take care.
Meanwhile, the government of France, which is Chad's former colonial power, said it learned of Debbie's death with, quote, emotion, end quote, and offered its condolences to the country. The statement called Debbie, quote, a brave friend, end quote. It said France stands with the people of Chad during this time and stressed the importance of a peaceful transition and a rapid return to civilian government. Next, door to Chad in Libya. The UN Security Council has unanimously passed a resolution calling for all foreign forces and mercenaries to leave the country. The council also gave the green light for a UN team to monitor last October's ceasefire agreement. An initial maximum of 60 personnel were approved by the UN team to work along the so-called 5+5 Joint Military Commission and its monitors. Wolfgang Putzai, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, discusses the details with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I would say certainly not, but this is definitely a starting point. The United Nations Secretary General requested and the United Nations Security Council approved the phased deployment of the UNSMIL ceasefire monitoring component, which would require an initial maximum number of 60 monitors. The decision is to deploy them to Sirte once conditions permit. So for the time being, they will stay in Tripoli. And as you've said, they will work alongside monitors of the 5+5 JMC, which consists of members of the Libyan Army, the former Operation Volcano of Rage, and from Khalifa Haftar's Libyan National Army. UN Security Council requested the 5+5 JMC to further develop their plans on a Libyan-led and Libyan-owned ceasefire monitoring mechanism, including some details about the deployment of the UNSMIL ceasefire monitoring component. But I need to say this Joint Military Commission for the time being did not make any significant progress so far after the signing of the ceasefire, other than a prison exchange. Not even the coastal road is opened, although they are discussing this since October. So without real significant international pressure, I'm sure that nothing will happen. But if those monitors are eventually deployed, the UN would have a foot in the door in Libya with regard to monitoring the ceasefire. And the UN Security Council requested the Secretary General to consult the Council again on any required increase of this maximum number of 60 monitors, so the way ahead to a positive development could be open.
The monitoring mechanism resolution also strongly urges states to support the October ceasefire agreement, including the withdrawal of all foreign forces and mercenaries from Libya without delay. Is that a realistic demand when the U.S. State Department has realized that there is a link between the Turkish and Russian military presence in Libya?
No, this is entirely unrealistic for the time being. State Department has really correctly realized that neither the Turks nor the Russians will depart if the other stays, and therefore they demanded both to get out immediately. There is no trust whatsoever that the other side will also withdraw if one side moves first. And this is where really efficient international ceasefire monitoring would come in. As for both the Emirates, who are probably financing the Russians, and the Turks with their ground-down economy, maintaining the troops in Libya is a quite costly adventure. So there is a chance that both could depart if this does not give the opportunity for the other side to prevail. And this makes it so important to get this ceasefire monitoring on the ground. Of course, for Turkey, it would be decisive to keep its special relationship with Libya as much as possible, even after its forces are gone. But I would say, I doubt this would fully happen in the way that President Erdogan wants to see it.
But the Russian mercenaries are digging in.
Yes, they are digging in. This means they are in a defensive position. They should act as some kind of tripwire in the case that the Turkish-supported Operation Volcano of Rage would start an offensive towards the east. This doesn't mean that they would not be able to depart from Libya. Actually, the defensive lines that they are building and digging out handing them over to mercenaries from various other countries, as it would be really a waste of efforts to take a Russian, quite costly mercenary, and put him in the middle of nowhere into a foxhole in the Sahara Desert.
That was Wolfgang Putzai, former Austrian military attaché to Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi. The UN Children's Fund warns the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray province is stripping tens of thousands of children of their rights, plunging them into a crisis that is causing them unimaginable, long-lasting harm. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF spokesman James Elder has just returned from a visit to Ethiopia's Tigray. He says his agency's fears for the welfare of children expressed at the onset of the conflict nearly 6 months ago now are being realized. Elder says children are suffering from a protection crisis as the incidence of rape and gender-based violence grows. Since the start of the year, he says just one UNICEF-supported center has been reporting an average of 3 cases of gender-based violence every day. Those are the reported cases, he says, adding the true number is certainly higher.
The personal stories I received from children who had been raped, or testimony of women who were victims of sexual violence, were harrowing and quite cruel. Yes, I heard traumatic stories of, you know, children as young as 14. I heard reports of gang rapes, quite bewildering.
Elder says authorities must publicly denounce the attacks and hold the perpetrators accountable. He says UNICEF is providing medical and psychosocial support to the survivors of sexual assault. He says children caught in the conflict also are suffering from education and nutritional emergencies. He says 1.4 million children have not been in school for more than a year. Of the many children he encountered on his visit to Tigray, Elder says the story of 16-year-old Merhewit remains seared in his mind.
She had walked 300 kilometers with her baby brother on her back from the west of the country amid pretty intense fighting. There was 300 kilometers and in broken flip-flops. Those stories abound. She was, you know, a star in physics, and now she's searching for food and hasn't seen a classroom in a year.
Last November, fighters from the Tigray People's Liberation Front attacked army bases in the region, according to the federal government. The attack, Ethiopia's prime minister said, prompted his government to launch a military offensive to push the group out. The conflict has interrupted harvesting activities, resulting in lost income and livelihoods. And now, because of the fighting, farmers cannot access their land to plant their crop, resulting in severe food shortages. Elder says that is causing a spike in malnutrition, with an increasing number of acutely malnourished children requiring life-saving treatment. He says UNICEF requires greater international support to meet the many protection, education, and nutritional needs of Tigray's children and women. He notes less than half of UNICEF's $47.6 million appeal for Tigray is funded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The past week's fire on South Africa's Table Mountain has injured 5 firefighters and destroyed several buildings at the University of Cape Town. The damage includes sections of the African Studies Library, which houses a number of ancient and rare works from the continent. The blaze is leading to talk about how to protect the iconic Table Mountain National Park, which has been designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. One man was arrested and has appeared in court in connection with the fire. Vicky Stark reports.
The man, who was allegedly spotted by residents making a fire on the mountain, remains behind bars pending his bail application. The National Prosecuting Authority's Eric Ntabazalila.
We can confirm that a 35-year-old man, Frederick Mangazo, appeared at the Cape Town Regional Court today. The Tanzanian national is charged with arson. His case has been postponed to the 28th of April 2021 for bail information.
South Africa's main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, has called for an independent investigation into the fire. Member of Parliament Dave Bryant, the Shadow Minister of Environment, says the fire has prompted much talk about how best to secure the mountain, which looms over Cape Town.
Cape Town is currently facing a number of challenges in as much as issues relating to urban homelessness. We do have a number of people sleeping rough in and around the city. And we do find that there are small camps of people, many of them who are immigrants from other countries, currently sleeping in and around on the lower slopes of the mountain. Those individuals are making fires, sometimes to keep warm, sometimes to cook food. And those fires do cause significant damage.
Brian says fencing isn't an option. Table Mountain National Park covers more than 220 square kilometres.
So what we do is we have certain areas where there is what's termed managed access, where we have a guard or we have somebody around who can observe who's coming on and off the mountain. But it's practically impossible to prevent access to the mountain, you know, via a perimeter fence or anything of that sort. So what we are asking for and what we'd like to see more of is increased surveillance, whether that be from the sky, from drones, or from other aerial apparatus, and an increase in patrols.
Bryant also wants the fire investigation to determine whether the entity that manages Table Mountain was negligent in not removing two banks of old pine trees from the vicinity of the University of Cape Town and Rhodes Memorial, where the restaurant was destroyed. He says the old pines could have contributed to the rapid spread of the blaze. Bryant also questions whether fire breaks were maintained and fire hydrants were working properly. The area was threatened by wildfires from drought in 2017 and 2018, but rains have reduced that risk.
The whole Table Mountain National Park is managed by the South African National Parks, which is a national government entity. South African National Parks is also responsible for the management of a number of game reserves, including the Kruger National Park, where we are also seeing significant challenges with a drop in the rhino population of 70% over the past 10 years. Sandparks is also in the midst of a number of other financial challenges, and they were reported to have had around about 200 million rand in irregular expenditure in the last financial year.
While the wind has died down, allowing choppers to water bomb the smoldering slopes of the mountain, firefighters remain on high alert for flare-ups. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent, 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. And thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
From the humdrum and dance to the beat of an African drum. Hi, I am David Van, host of the Voice of America's African Beat. Splendid sounds from the continent that all humanity calls home. Join me Monday through Friday at 0900 and 2000 UTC for a soothing musical jam. I guarantee it.
Around the clock, the Voice of America provides you with comprehensive African and world news. Wake up with Daybreak Africa. Then in the evening, listen to Africa News Tonight. And on weekends, it's Nightline Africa. In between, you'll hear VOA newscasts at the top of each hour. VOA, bringing the world to you.
Hello, sports fans. This is the voice of America's Sonny Young. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC for the sunny side of sports. On Fridays, you can also hear my expanded 30-minute edition of the show at 17:30 UTC, right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America.